Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Nadia Hamdan, sitting in for Al Letson.
Let's go!
Hundreds of activists sailed to Gaza in the hopes of delivering aid and protesting the war.
All of this preparation, all of this work, it's actually come together. And we're sailing east, finally. We're heading towards Gaza.
But soon, they came under attack by drones.
I hear a huge explosion.
Cover, cover, cover!
And were arrested by the Israeli Navy.
We were at gunpoint, like you could see the laser on our chest.
And their very first command was shut your eyes.
Today on Reveal, we go aboard the Global Sumud Flotilla. First, this news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Herbst. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is defending the U.S. military strikes on alleged drug cartel boats. Speaking today at a national security forum at the Reagan Presidential Library in California, he says the strikes will continue.
We are tracking them, we are killing them, and we will keep killing them so long as they are poisoning our people with narcotics so lethal that they're tantamount to chemical weapons.
This as the Pentagon announced the U.S. conducted another strike on Thursday. On social media, U.S. Southern Command says the small boat was carrying drugs in the Eastern Pacific and released a brief surveillance video of a boat bursting into flames. The announcement of the new attack came hours after Admiral Mitch Bradley briefed congressional leaders behind closed doors about the first strike that took place on September 2nd. And a bipartisan congressional oversight is now underway into that first attack, especially on the decision to fire a second missile at the vessel, killing two survivors of that blast. Millions of Americans 65 years and older are finalizing their 2026 Medicare enrollment. Macy Byers with Nebraska Public Radio reports on the choice between traditional Medicare and privatized options.
Some private insurance companies offer Medicare Advantage plans with low monthly premiums and extra benefits. But analysts say premiums and out-of-pocket costs are expected to tick up nationally next year. Nebraska Hospital Association President Jeremy Nordquist works with seniors navigating those costs.
A lot of Medicare Advantage plans, you may pay less up front, but you are taking a bigger financial risk as you age and move forward.
Nationwide, 62 million people can choose Medicare Advantage. Advantage plans may require prior approval for certain services, something Nordquist says can delay or deny care for seniors. For NPR News, I'm Macy Byers in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Hong Kong is pressing ahead with highly managed legislative elections this weekend, despite the fact that authorities are still searching for human remains after a massive blaze killed at least 159 people in one of the deadliest fires in a century in the region. NPR's Emily Fang reports.
On Sunday, Hong Kong will choose its next legislative council. The region is championing it as a patriots-only election, and in fact, only 20 of the 90 seats on the council will be directly elected. 30 seats are chosen by committees reflecting Hong Kong's industrial interests, and a Beijing-appointed committee chooses the rest, ever since Beijing overhauled election rules in 2021. But the elections are still a litmus test for the region's chief executive, John Lee. He is under pressure to deliver a transparent investigation after the fire, and he's hoping to be chosen for a second term. Emily Fang, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
Live from KQED News, I'm Rachel Vasquez. West Contra Costa Unified School District officials and two striking unions are back to the bargaining table today. Francisco Ortiz, president of the teachers union, says the group will hold a candlelight vigil as talks get underway this afternoon.
Well, you know, it's been a hard and difficult last couple of days. And, you know, candles signify hope. We're hopeful that we can come to an agreement, and it's up to management to, you know, make that happen.
The Teamsters Union, which represents classroom aides, clerical workers, and food service staff, is encouraging its members to hold strong. The district has said it understands staff concerns about pay and benefits, but says the strike could worsen the district's financial problems. Drought conditions in California are improving, with only parts of the state's southern half abnormally dry, according to the latest U.S. Drought Monitor map. That's after heavy rains in October and November, and despite a lower-than-average snowpack so far this year. Andrew Schwartz is the director of the UC Berkeley Central Sierra Snow Lab.
Even though we don't have a ton of snow yet, the rains made up for that a little bit, but we definitely want to see more snow start falling soon.
Schwartz says California ski resorts are starting to get anxious about the lower-than-average snowpack, but the 10-day forecast shows there's a chance of some snow in the Sierras. I'm Rachel Vasquez, KQED News.
Support for NPR comes from the Cy Sims Foundation since 1985, supporting advances in science education and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And support comes from you, the listeners and supporters and members of KQED. It's that time of year not only for low-hanging fog, but also for coastal flood advisories with the king tides, and they are in effect until tomorrow afternoon.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Nadia Hamdan, sitting in for Al Letson. In late September, somewhere on the Mediterranean Sea, my friend Luna Spoo sent me this voice note.
Well, it's crazy to know that I'm laying in a room where to my left and right and everywhere around me is the sea. I don't know if you can hear it in the background, but that's the sea.
The engine is off and the boat is just drifting. Luna is laying on her back, looking through a ceiling window.
And I'm seeing a bit of the sky with very visible, bright stars, two drones, and just a very clear Milky Way. It's such a gorgeous image. I think I need to sit with it. And then the sound of the sea. Gorgeous.
Less than 48 hours after sending me this message, Luna would be detained by the Israeli Navy, driven out to the Negev Desert, and locked up in one of the country's most brutal prisons, all because she wanted to deliver aid to Gaza.
Israeli forces have intercepted a number of boats that are part of a flotilla attempting to break the naval blockade of Gaza.
Luna was on one of the 42 boats that sailed to Gaza earlier this fall, as part of the Global Samud Flotilla. It's described itself as a peaceful, nonviolent mission, attempting to create a humanitarian corridor by sea. Samud means steadfastness in Arabic, a reference to what Palestinians have been forced to endure the last 2 years in Gaza.
The death toll is believed to have surpassed 67,000. Among that number is more than 18,000 children.
It is a famine, the Gaza famine.
A United Nations investigation team says Israel has committed genocide against Palestinians.
Organizers of the flotilla say they received around 30,000 applications to join the mission. It's now been a couple of months since the flotilla was in the news, and since then, the world has largely moved on. I mean, I get it. A ceasefire and a peace deal were declared, albeit not necessarily honored. But I keep thinking about the flotilla. When it was first announced, people didn't really take it seriously. Nearly 500 well-meaning activists, many of whom had never sailed a day in their life, crowded onto a bunch of boats, thinking they could end one of the worst humanitarian crises on the planet with Instagram. It was easy to dismiss the flotilla, until it wasn't. So today, we join Luna and her crewmates for an exclusive look into the Global Samud Flotilla and find out what, if anything, it achieved. I've known Luna for over a decade. We met back in my early 20s when we were both living in Beirut and then again in Berlin. We used to see each other almost every day. But then I moved back to the U.S. and we got busy with our own respective lives on different continents. Nowadays, we go long stretches without speaking. But when she went on the flotilla, I was back to checking in with her daily, asking for updates. Boats taking part in the flotilla originated from several ports, including Spain, Tunisia, and the port of Catania in Sicily, which is where Luna arrived on August 31st.
Good morning. It's 7:58.
She started sending me voice notes right away.
Hola. Okay, I had my first sip of coffee. So needed. I have no idea how I'm going to do it on the boat.
It very quickly started to feel like I was there with her.
Well, there's a baby cat. You would love it.
Luna is Moroccan, but born and raised in Germany. A mother of two. She's soft-spoken, but formidable, with dark curly hair and a line tattoo down the middle of her chin, meant to reflect her ancestral connection to the indigenous people of North Africa, known as the Amazigh. And Luna has always considered herself an activist. For her, some things are just black and white, right or wrong. And for as long as I've known her, Palestinian solidarity has always been one of those hard lines. But it reached an inflection point the past 2 years of the war.
I just have to say, these are humans. That these are humans who are capable of starving kids and civilians. I mean, the level of rage that we've been feeling is extraordinary. And it's really hard to stay sane.
So when one of the organizers of the Global Sumud Flotilla invited her to join, she was interested. But she'd never done anything remotely like this before. She'd also never left her kids this long. Still, if there was a chance it could make even a modicum of difference, it would be worth it. So she said yes. One of the people Luna would sail with is Carsey Blanton, a singer-songwriter based in New Jersey.
When October 7th happened and it became clear very quickly that as a Jewish person, like my identity was being used in this propaganda push against Palestinian people, that was not okay with me.
Carsey was already a public figure with a large social media following, which made her a perfect candidate for the flotilla.
I got a DM from someone who was like recruiting influencers to go on the flotilla. And they were like, would you ever consider applying? And I was like, I already applied. You have my application. Call me anytime.
This aspect of the flotilla, that it was actively recruiting influencers and celebrities, has been a point of contention for some. The Israeli Foreign Ministry called it a, quote, selfie yacht. And critics have argued that many people on the boat were just doing it for attention, and it was nothing more than a publicity stunt.
And my take on that is like, yes, of course it's a publicity stunt. Like, so much of politics is propaganda, and Israel and the U.S. are making like trillions of dollars worth of propaganda all the time. So if you can get 100 influencers onto some sailboats to make your own propaganda for free, definitely do that.
I saw Carsey Blanton had a video out saying that she was joining the Global Sumud Flotilla.
Dane Hunter is from the British Virgin Islands and has been a fan of Carsey's music for years. So he messaged her.
I just commented on her video saying, hey, I'm a sailor, like wondering if they need any hands.
Carsey quickly connected him with one of the organizers for a phone interview.
And they asked if I could come out the next day, and I said sure.
Dane arrived in Sicily on September 1st. To help prepare the boats.
In terms of what kind of boats we had, all of them. We had sailboats, we had motorboats, we had small boats, we had big boats, very Dr. Seuss kind of boats. The common denominator, I would say, was fixer-upper.
So Dane joined a group of volunteers who had to make sure they were all ship-shape. Or as Luna put it,
ship-shift. Ship-shift safe, making all ships safe, ship-shift safe, and then we have to make everything shape-shift, ship-safe. What is that word, shape-shift?
She ultimately got there. Plumbers, electricians, engineers, organizers say they all donated their time and expertise to outfit these rinky-dink boats, not just making sure they were safe, but also jerry-rigging them with things like Starlink and cameras so they could live stream their journey on social media.
Me and the mechanic would look at each other and we'd be like, I mean, it's a one-way trip. It really just needs to hold up for 3 weeks. And we'd be like, zip ties? Yeah, zip ties. Let's do that.
So many people, Nadia, just came to Catania just to help prepare the boats, which is enormous, enormous amount of work.
This is Yassine Benjaloun, who also arrived early to help prepare the boats. Yassine works for a tech company. He's Moroccan, but was born and raised in Montreal and currently lives in Paris.
You hear your parents talk about how the first intifada, the second intifada, people's homes getting stolen and people's not being able to come back. And so all these conversations growing up, you know, they are why I think I went on this flotilla.
Organizers say the boats would be loaded with as much aid as they could carry. Things like canned foods, medicine, and baby formula.
It's nothing in comparison to what they need.
And once they were all ready to go, they would all leave from Sicily together and sail towards Gaza.
Many of us have never sailed before, most of us, I would argue.
The Global Samud Flotilla says there were a total of 42 boats carrying 462 people from 45 different countries. This was undoubtedly the largest and most ambitious flotilla attempting to sail to Gaza, but it was not the first. Israel's naval blockade of Gaza began in 2009, a year and a half after Hamas took control of the territory. Israeli officials argued that it was necessary to prevent the group from getting weapons delivered by sea. But critics of the blockade have long argued that it violates international law because it's collectively punishing Palestinian civilians, severely restricting their movements, the importing of goods, even their ability to fish. Since Israel's blockade began, dozens of flotillas have tried to reach Gaza and create a humanitarian corridor. In those first few years, everything remained largely peaceful, and five flotillas actually made it to Gaza. But that changed in 2010, aboard the Mavi Marmara.
Tens of people, civilians, have been injured. There are still sounds of live fire despite the white flag being raised on board the ship, which holds 600, all of whom are civilians.
10 people were killed by Israeli forces. An investigation by the International Criminal Court said it believed what happened on the Mavi Marmara constituted a war crime. Israel agreed to pay $20 million in restitution to the families of the victims. And still, the flotillas have not stopped. Most of them have been intercepted by the Israeli Navy and the people arrested and sent home. All of this was expressly laid out to everyone going on this flotilla. And on top of all of that, Israel's National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, had publicly called everyone on the flotilla a terrorist, alleging that they were not actually humanitarians, but Hamas collaborators. And they will, quote, meet a firm and unyielding response from Israel. I asked Luna if this worried her at all.
If we would let them scare us, why would we then continue or even start this mission? I think it's important that we just continue and we'll see what happens.
The Barcelona fleet had already been sailing for a week when they stopped in a Tunisian port on September 7th. The plan was to take a break and then continue on to meet the rest of the fleet in Sicily. But around 11:30 p.m. the following night, a drone dropped an incendiary device on the family, the lead boat carrying all the main organizers of the flotilla. The fire was put out and no one was hurt. GSF organizer Yasmin Achar quickly took to social media and accused Israel of the attack.
They have bombed a boat once again with civilians on it in Tunisian territory. This is an attack against Gaza because they don't want us there.
Then a second drone attack happened the following night. Again, there were no injuries or damage. Israel has neither confirmed nor denied the allegations that they were responsible for these attacks. But CBS News reported that two American intelligence officials, speaking under anonymity, told them that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had approved the strikes and that the drones had been launched from a nearby submarine. A few people reportedly left the mission after the attacks, but Luna said most everyone she spoke to saw this as nothing more than a scare tactic. For Carsey, this was not only a scare tactic, but a big miscalculation.
I remember my mom sent me a New York Times article about that. And I remember walking around the port in Sicily, like, did you guys see this? The New York Times covered it. We have the attention of the world in a way that is unusual. And so, again, we have to see this thing through.
Most people just continued as normal, loading boats and preparing to set sail. Luna's boat was called Paula One. It's a small sailboat that can fit 10 people. And Luna tells me she hasn't always liked everyone she's met on this mission, but she liked her crew. It wasn't long before they were all laughing and playing music together. The vibes were good. The boat was loaded, and they were ready to go. But they were told they had to wait for the fleets coming from Tunisia, who were still running behind.
Then they kind of kept telling us, so one more day, just one more day, guys. And it really got to the point where it was feeling like, you know, one of those friends calling you up saying, oh, I'm almost there. And, you know, they haven't even put their pants on yet.
Everyone in Sicily had originally been told they would set sail on September 4th. And the entire trip was supposed to take around 2 weeks total. Now it was pushing 2 weeks, and they hadn't even started sailing. Boats kept breaking down. There were weather concerns. Seasickness was a real issue. Not to mention the steering committee was also juggling the wants and needs of nearly 500 different people.
I would argue maybe 60% of the mission was to manage everyone's desires and fears and complications and baggage and, you know, the way they see life.
People were getting antsy. Some had kids back home, parents with dementia. A few even lost their jobs to be here. They were getting nervous that this whole thing was about to fall apart. Not to mention the airstrikes in Gaza were only intensifying. And some people couldn't hide their frustrations anymore.
Wow, who is calling on all of this?
This is Hamish Patterson, captain of the boat Oahu, in one of the many Zoom meetings they had about the delays.
Yes, can you just
And there was a minor mutiny of sorts.
We're not waiting anymore, we're going. But then only three of us actually left. And then a fourth boat had to come get us physically and say, we're forming a captain's union, come back.
After Paula One and the other boats returned, captains came together and created a list of demands to the steering committee. Any boats that weren't ready to sail right now would not go on the mission, and they would leave the following day at 10 a.m., no question.
And if they were not all met, every captain would walk.
So the steering committee agreed.
And so the miracle to me was that we did kind of reorganize it from within, and also nobody canceled it. You got 500 leftists from everywhere in the world to get together, do a thing that was clearly not very functional, and instead of like whistleblowing on each other, everybody just like got our hands dirty and made it work. And to me, that's like the proudest, that's a really proud moment for the left.
And so the Global Samud Flotilla officially set sail.
Oh man, so getting underway finally was magical. Everybody cheering, everybody screaming.
Let's get out of here. Let's go!
Just this sense of, you know, we're doing it, you know? All of this preparation, all of this work, it's actually come together. And we're sailing east finally. We're heading towards Gaza.
With sails unfurled, Paula 1 joins dozens of boats heading across the Mediterranean. There's a feeling of hope on the high seas.
There's a cargo ship! Oh my gosh!
But it wouldn't last long.
Cover, cover, cover!
That's coming up on Reveal.
Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. Odoo streamlines every aspect of your company in one simple and efficient business management platform. More information at odoo.com. That's O-D-O-O.com. And by Progressive Insurance. Progressive Insurance. With the Name Your Price tool, offering a range of coverage and price options to choose from. Now that's Progressive. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Covering the military is Tom Bowman's job, but when the Defense Department asked him to sign a pledge that would restrict his journalism, he turned in the press pass he's had for nearly 30 years. That hasn't stopped him, though.
You're going to try to do that to us? We're going to find a way to get the information for the American people. Period.
How NPR's Pentagon correspondent still reports, even after being barred from the building, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Coming up at 5 o'clock this afternoon in just over half an hour, support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com. And the Watermark at San Jose, a senior living community providing assisted living and memory care with amenities like on-site restaurants, a fitness center, and spa and salon services. Learn more at sanjosewatermark.com. This is KQED News.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Nadia Hamdan, sitting in for Al Letson.
The day we left, I was jumping on the boat, chanting, and I kept, you know, doing the very loud horn all the time.
After weeks of feeling stuck, everyone on Paula 1 comes alive on the water. It starts to feel a little like a Disney movie. Luna sends me videos of sunrises, dolphins.
Wow. Wow.
And of Carsey leading everyone in song at sunset.
Even if we don't survive, we keep that little flame alive.
We keep that little flame alive.
For the river cross.
It was so beautiful. It was like the most beautiful experience of my life. And the hardest. It was the best of times and the worst of times.
Because it's not all sing-alongs and lovable sea creatures. For one, they all have to get a crash course in sailing. The plan is to take shifts manning the boat at night so everyone can get some sleep.
And so I was teaching all of my crew in the night and quizzing them constantly, like, okay, that boat, do we have to worry about it? No, you know, they're off our starboard and they're going starboard. Correct. That boat, do we have to worry about? Yes, yes, we do. Let's turn right now.
Okay, we're going to tack. We got to tack until we get there.
I'm going to tack. Ready to tack.
Everybody on board Paula came out as a sailor.
Go. Yeah, nice. Looking good.
And while things are pretty mellow, the boats are being followed by a few drones.
I'm actually seeing one right now. It's above our window, above the mast.
They're far enough away that they don't feel threatening, but the crew wants to be prepared for anything. So at night, they practice drills on how they would respond in different emergency situations. Luna records one of these drills, in which she pretends to be the Israeli Defense Forces coming to arrest them.
Get your passports, your phone, everything! Hurry up!
The goal is to get passports ready, life vests on, and hands in the air as fast as possible.
Are you the captain?
They all stay silent.
Are you the captain?
Because they were instructed not to identify the captain.
Sabrina, see how much fun that was.
And everyone learns just how loud a soft-spoken Luna can be.
I'm sorry.
It is our fault. We told her about
2.5 minutes.
By the fifth night on the water, the crew is feeling pretty confident.
It was a very calm evening.
There's a light breeze, virtually no waves.
And I think I even mentioned to Luna, yeah, I think I'm actually going to get some rest tonight.
It's Luna's shift. At this point, Dane trusts her at the helm, so he tells her to just wake him up if there are any issues. And then something strange happens with the two-way radio.
Can we turn up the volume?
Yeah. I heard something.
There was something here, right?
The ABBA song, Take a Chance on Me, starts blaring on the flotilla's radio frequency.
Okay. Should we wake people up just to stay alert?
I think so.
Serious?
What the
f***? It was cutting in and out, and they scrambled our own communications, and it'd be like, and then Take a Chance on Me would play. It was very horror movie-like.
This is creepy.
Yeah, this is
creepy. Most of the crew is getting nervous and starts scanning the skies for drones.
Like, a star became a drone. An airplane became a drone. The word drone was said out loud many times when it was not.
Yassine even tells Carsey, maybe we're overreacting.
And she's like, yeah, I don't really know, but okay. So I go to bed, we're sharing a bunk bed, and I hear a huge explosion.
Now, Luna and I had been texting since that ABBA song first came on the radio. I remember telling her I had a bad feeling, but she told me not to worry. This is just another scare tactic. And then, I kid you not, I get a text literally a second later that just reads, bomb, exclamation point. I text her, no answer. I call her, no answer. I remember just feeling paralyzed. Finally, after the longest few minutes of my life, she calls me. And I just stay on the phone and listen.
Five phones on starboard side. One phone is getting lower.
At this point, everyone is on deck scanning the skies. The first explosion, they had only heard. It had gone off somewhere in the back of the fleet. 10 to 15 minutes later, there's another explosion.
And that one we actually saw. We saw the bright flash of it. And then we really realized just how many drones were all around us. I mean, yeah, the sky was littered with stars and drones.
Then another explosion.
Explosion in front, one.
And another.
Oh, there it goes.
And another.
Explosion. Which boat is that? Salvaccia? You okay? Is everyone okay?
For Dane, the scariest moment is when a drone hovers right over their boat.
And we could hear this thing, we could see this thing. It was like a massive wasp. And right away, I remember Luna called out for everybody to get down, and we all just hunkered in place.
Cover, cover, cover!
We all got down and we all braced.
Oh my God. It's okay. Breathe.
I stay glued to my phone as reports of the attacks begin to reach the news and social media.
And at that moment, Nadia, I look at my phone, and so I grew up in the Muslim faith, the Islamic faith, and there's this very famous sentence, I'm sure you maybe heard or not, that Muslims say the moment they think they're going to die or the moment they die.
The phrase is, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raja'un.
We belong to God, and to God we shall return. And so I look at my phone, and I see my mother sends me in Arabic that text message. And that was pretty hard to live, because am I going to die? Like, is this the end?
Thankfully, his mother was wrong.
After four or five strikes, it became clear they were all at the front of the boats, they were all near the sails. And then we're like, okay, they're trying to, like, make us scared and or hurt our sails.
Soon, the sun starts to come up. 4 hours have gone by, and I'm still on the phone with Luna.
Does it seem to be calming down?
It's hard to say.
I know.
I was pretty excited.
In the end, organizers say there were at least 13 explosions on or around the boats. We learn later that these were mainly a mix of flashbangs and incendiary devices that did end up damaging three of the boats. No injuries were reported. This all happened in international waters, just south of Crete. So the flotilla decides to stop in Greek waters to regroup. Process. They quickly point their fingers at Israel, which neither confirms nor denies the allegations. And after hearing reports there could be more attacks, about a dozen people decide to leave. Those who stay still believe all of this was a scare tactic, a way to get them to abandon the mission. But they don't want to stop. And it turns out thousands of other people don't want them to stop either. Protests break out in places like Italy, Spain, Turkey, and Ireland. And that pressure actually seems to do something. Both Spain and Italy agree to send warships to accompany the flotilla as a precaution, and Turkey, a couple military drones.
This mission has become about more than delivering aid. It's testing the gap between the world's rhetoric and its willingness to act.
And so the flotilla sets sail once more. It's September 29th, a month since Luna left home. And this is the moment where we began, with Luna laying on her back, looking through a ceiling window as the boat just drifts.
And I'm seeing a bit of the sky with very visible, bright stars, two drones, and just a very clear Milky Way. It's such a gorgeous image. I think I need to sit with it.
This would be the last moment of calm for Paolo One. 2 days after leaving Greece, the flotilla is within 150 nautical miles of Gaza. The Spanish and Italian warships turn around, but people start noticing other military vessels in the distance, and they keep getting closer. On October 1st, this message comes across everyone's radio.
This is the Israeli Navy. You are approaching a blockaded zone. Attempting to reach the Gaza Strip via sea while breaching the naval blockade violates international law.
The Israeli Navy urges the flotilla to redirect their boats to the port of Ashdod in Israel, where the military would deliver the aid for them.
Any further attempt to sail toward Gaza endangers your safety and places you within an active war zone. You bear full responsibility for your actions.
Luna and I responded to them on the radio each time they would send a message like that.
They would quote various international laws, including Article 59 of the Geneva Convention, which basically requires any occupying power to either supply the civilian population with basic necessities, such as food, water, medicine, and clothing, or allow safe passage for humanitarian groups, like the Red Cross, who can provide that assistance. So despite the warnings from Israel, the global Sumud flotilla continues towards Gaza.
Because the protocol said you go. Like, we don't stop, we just continue.
The flotilla is currently in international waters. And this is where things get really nuanced. According to the UN, everyone is allowed freedom of navigation on international waters and cannot be intercepted, save some exceptions, such as piracy and the slave trade. That's why the activists and some legal experts say interception of any kind is illegal. But Israel argues that under the laws of naval warfare, if someone tries to breach a military blockade, a navy is within its right to intercept them. And so they do.
Behind me is the military vessel. They are intercepting us right now. We do not know how they will intercept us.
Luna's crewmates send me videos. It's dark, but you can see some stuff. Bright lights shining onto the boat, zodiacs speeding by, nearby boats being hit with giant water cannons.
You know, there was a submarine out there with us. There was this big, like, mothership huge barge-looking thing. There were, like, three frigates versus, you know, 40 boats that we, like, patched together with duct tape.
The Navy boards boats one by one and takes over the controls. Everyone throws their phones and computers in the water so that the Israeli military can't access their data. So when I stop getting videos from Paula 1, I know it must be happening.
Before they boarded, we were at gunpoint. Like, you could see the laser on our chest.
And their very first command was shut your eyes. And we heard them quietly, methodically going around, tearing off the Starlink, tearing off the camera, checking the inside of the boat.
The first question they ask is, who is the captain?
And nobody said anything. Oh, so you're all the captain? You think this is funny? And then just guns cocking. And we all just quickly, you know, wipe the smile off our faces.
It takes the Israeli Navy nearly 48 hours to take over all the boats. Everyone is brought to the port of Ashdod and made to sit on the ground of a parking lot, zip-tied, for hours. It's late at night when Israel's national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, arrives at the port.
And so then we're like, oh, that's why they zip-tied us, so that Ben-Gvir can, like, post on his TikTok, like, look at all these terrorists. We're treating them like terrorists.
Ben-Gvir's video cuts off abruptly. I'm told this was because everyone started chanting Free Palestine. At one point, Luna remembers people yelling behind her and tries to see what's happening.
And I see that they've placed a woman on the ground right in front of an Israeli flag. Someone pulled her hair so that she would have her head looking at the flag. And she must have been there for hours. And then I realized, that's Greta.
Greta Thunberg, the now famous climate activist, was on the flotilla and seemed to be singled out by the soldiers.
And they would take selfies, they would spit at her, they would kick her and fix the flag so that it would touch her constantly.
Everyone is then sent through an immigration processing center. They're asked to sign a document saying they illegally entered the country of Israel. Everyone on Paula 1 refuses to sign it, arguing that they never wanted to come here and had been kidnapped. Dane remembers one Israeli soldier turns to him and says, "You're helping terrorists."
And I push back saying, "Hey man, my boat just had baby formula." And I kid you not, this guy, without blinking, looks at me and says, "Fine, future terrorists." That's when I was like, oh man, that's f***ed up, dude. Like, how do you fix that?
People on previous flotillas have been detained in the past, but this was the first time they were sent to Ketziot, a high-security detention facility deep in the Negev desert.
That was the part that, like, for my soft Western brain was a new understanding. Being detained is not like being in prison. It's not. You don't have anything. You have no control, you have no information, and you have no rights. They can do whatever they want to you.
And the first-hand accounts paint a disturbing picture. Some allege being beaten and kicked, threatened and humiliated, denied medication, food for long periods, and clean drinking water for days. Woken up in the middle of the night with dogs barking in their faces. Others say they were forced to stand outside in the hot sun for hours until they fainted.
I mean, it was devastating.
The Israeli Foreign Ministry called the claims of mistreatment, quote, brazen lies, and that all detainees' legal rights were fully upheld. But their national security minister, Ben-Gvir, said he was proud of the fact that they were treating the activists like terrorists. In a statement, he said, quote, whoever supports terrorism is a terrorist. It is worthwhile for them to experience the conditions in Ketziot prison and think twice before they come close to Israel again. Yassin and everyone else I spoke to were quick to make one thing clear. This was nothing compared to what Palestinian detainees were experiencing.
I know for a fact that we got it, like, way easy. It was Disneyland for us. You know, we were on a field trip of a prison experience because, you know, we had the good passports. We had the cameras of the world looking at us.
Amnesty International and the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem have accused Israeli authorities of abuse and inhumane treatment of Palestinian prisoners, many of whom are being held under administrative detention, a policy that allows officials to hold people without charges or a formal trial indefinitely. According to data from B'Tselem, as of September 2025, nearly 3,500 administrative detainees were being held across the Israeli prison system.
And so what we did is to start shouting chants, free, free Palestine, free, free Palestine. And you know that they hear you. You know that they're there.
Yassin, Luna, and Dane joined dozens of people who took part in a hunger strike while they were detained.
Then one guard was trying to force me to take a sandwich. And I was telling him, give it to a Palestinian. Like, I'm not eating any of your food. And yeah, I just threw the sandwich at him. I just couldn't help myself.
Everyone from Paola One tells me the entire experience only made them feel closer to the very people they spent years protesting for. Carsey remembers finding a broken pen hidden in one of the cells.
Like, without the plastic part, just the inside part of the pen. Like, this was almost certainly a Palestinian prisoner smuggled this pen in here, and they could have been in here for years.
They all remember seeing writing all over their cell walls, mostly in Arabic. People wrote their names, where they were from, phrases like, God give us strength. There were also poems and song verses.
Like, some of them were songwriters, Like, I'm not different from these people.
Using that same pen, they all added their own names to the cell walls. And next to them, they drew a sailboat. Coming up, the prisoners from the flotilla are released. And even though they didn't reach Gaza, they're surprised to learn their voyage still had an impact.
Carsey and I looked at each other. I remember we just said, we did something.
You're listening to Reveal.
Support for KQED comes from Frontline PBS, presenting 2,000 Meters to Andriivka, a documentary about Ukrainian soldiers fighting for every inch of their land in the Russian-Ukraine war, now streaming on PBS.org and the PBS app, awards eligible. And Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. And Check Please Bay Area. It's celebrating 20 years of Bay Area food, culture, and community. You can watch the special anniversary season as local diners share their favorite Bay Area restaurants. Catch Check Please Bay Area Thursdays on KQED 9 or stream it anytime at kqed.org/checkplease.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Nadia Hamdan, sitting in for Al Letson. It's October 6th, and a crowd has formed at the Athens airport to welcome back around 160 flotilla members who have just been released from Ketziot prison. Greta Thunberg is one of them.
And I could talk for a very, very long time about our mistreatment and abuses in our imprisonment, trust me, but that is not the story.
Most people's stuff was either tossed or confiscated, but Greta got her luggage back. Except now, the words "Whore Greta" were written on it with permanent marker. Next to that, a drawing of an Israeli flag and a penis. Luna was on the same flight as Greta after nearly a week in detainment.
I think a lot of us have underestimated the impact of the violence that we've endured, but we're processing. It might take some time, but
have you called a therapist yet?
Luna's partner Nina is sitting next to her.
I messaged them.
We reached out to the Israeli government multiple times to ask about the allegations of mistreatment in Ketziot and what evidence they had to suggest the activists were colluding with Hamas. We asked about the drone attacks and allegations that the Israeli military was responsible. And we wanted to know what happened to the aid after the boats were confiscated by the Navy. Israeli officials did not respond. Everyone on the flotilla wasn't released all at once. Remember, these are people from dozens of different countries, and each of their respective embassies was handling the release of its own citizens. Yassin was one of the first to leave.
And I was there, you know, drinking water, having my meal on Turkish Airlines, and flying over Gaza, the place where we were trying to enter. And it felt so surreal, so surreal.
Karsi, Dane, and other U.S. citizens were held another 3 days, making them some of the last to leave.
Many of us, the Americans, were like, we have the quote-unquote strongest passport because Israel really cares what the U.S. thinks. What we hadn't calculated was that by making ourselves an enemy of the Israeli state, we had also made ourselves an enemy of the American state.
They were released on October 7th, the 2-year anniversary of the war in Gaza. Karsi and Dane tell me they were bused to Israel's border with Jordan and pretty much left to fend for themselves.
We saw that other consulates, other ambassadors were there with trays of food, bottles of water, packs of cigarettes.
The U.S. person from the embassy shows up and is like, I just want you to know we're not going to be babysitting you. You guys are going to have to find your own way home.
And when she had found out that we were on hunger strike, she dug through her purse and had like half a bag of a snack sized thing of pretzels, which she offered to us.
So that was the welcome of the U.S. embassy.
I reached out to the State Department and the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem to ask about this incident. They did not respond. The flotilla organizers get in touch with the Americans and tell them to meet at a hotel in the heart of Jordan's capital, Amman. Dane says they walked in looking and smelling terrible, but the welcome they got from the owner of the hotel was a stark contrast to everything they just experienced.
She came around and hugged each of us, and then she let us know that there was a buffet for us upstairs. And I remember walking up and seeing Karsi staring, and she looks at me and she says, there's a chocolate fountain, and then she just starts weeping.
Dane says, sitting at that hotel in Jordan, they couldn't help but feel like they'd failed. They hadn't broken the blockade. They hadn't delivered the aid. He says it wasn't until he was in a taxi on the way to the airport that he started to feel differently. The driver had just finished his night shift, but wanted to take them free of charge.
This gentleman let us know that many Palestinians, his family included, were able to fish for 2 days while the Israeli Navy was occupied with us. And everybody in the taxi just broke down crying. And like Karsi and I looked at each other, and I remember we just said, we did something.
Well, yeah. Actually, we could see the fish in the market.
This is Abir Barakat, a Palestinian woman in Gaza.
So when Israel was occupied with the Global Samud Flotilla, the fishermen were able to go into the sea and at least catch few fish. And I was so happy for them.
Abir and her family lost their home 2 years ago, just a few days into the war. She's now living with her in-laws in Gaza City.
And it's the last remaining home for the extended family. So if anything happened around here to this area, I think I will have no place to call home.
A ceasefire brokered by the Trump administration began on October 10th, but Israeli airstrikes have continued, killing hundreds of Palestinian civilians. Israel blames Hamas for violating the ceasefire. Hamas blames Israel. And still, President Trump is moving forward with a peace deal. Although Abir says that's not what she would call it.
If you were to give this peace deal another name, what would you call it?
The deal of shame. This is what I call it. Because it's like they are putting a gun to your head and a knife to your neck and telling you you must accept it.
Abir is a lecturer and PhD candidate who used to spend her days teaching English at the University College of Applied Sciences in Gaza. Now, Abir spends her days doing what she calls Stone Age chores. She builds a fire to heat water for coffee, makes bread for breakfast, waits for a truck to come by once a day with fresh drinking water. Lunch is usually canned beans.
When I look at my life, it's very miserable. My God, I look at my hand. They used to be very soft. Now they look very black. I have many cuts on my fingers, bruises. I have burns from the wood fire. And my God. Just thinking about this makes me have this kind of self-pity because of this kind of, you know, abrupt transition in life.
When the flotilla started making the news, Israel and other critics argued that this was largely a publicity stunt and that it was taking away attention from people like Abir rather than bringing it.
Well, actually, we don't feel like that at all. In my opinion, to see international activists sailing toward Gaza, risking their freedom to challenge an illegal blockade, reminds us that our struggle is not isolated and tells Palestinians you are not alone and the world still sees you.
And it really did feel like the world was watching. The Israelis' interception and detainment of the flotilla prompted worldwide protests that eclipsed the ones we saw after the drone attacks.
From Israel's border with Gaza to London, Athens, Barcelona, Zurich, Geneva, and Europe's largest pro-Palestinian rallies in Milan, Naples, and Rome.
Italy's largest labor union even held a general strike that effectively shut down the entire country. And it wasn't just Europe. There were protests in Malaysia and Bangladesh, Turkey and Tunisia, the U.S., Brazil, and Colombia, where President Gustavo Petro expelled all of Israel's diplomats and ended the free trade agreement between the two countries.
Justice for Palestine has become a global issue of conscience. It's no longer confined to the region. People everywhere are connecting the dots between Gaza and the broader struggles for equality and liberation. So that, to me, is a source of real hope.
While others may not share Abir's optimism, it's become clear that more and more people around the world are changing the way they feel about this conflict. In the U.S., the shift has been described as seismic, with a recent poll by the New York Times finding that, for the first time, voters now sympathize more with Palestinians than with Israelis. As for the global Sumud flotilla, organizers say until the blockade of Gaza is lifted, they will continue sailing. The next mission is scheduled for spring. This week's show was edited by Taki Telenidis. Special thanks to Cynthia Rodriguez and Kate Howard. Artist Chiriscus is our fact checker. Legal review by James Chadwick. Our production manager is Zulema Cobb. Score and sound design by Jim Briggs and Fernando Arruda. They had help from Claire Mullen. Our executive producer is Brett Myers. Our theme music is by Camerato Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the Park Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and the Hellman Foundation. Support for Reveal is also provided by you, our listeners. We are a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Nadia Hamdan, and remember, there is always more to the story.
All Things Considered is coming up next.
From PRX.
here on KQED News, where support comes from BART. BART connects riders to holiday events around the Bay, ballet, theater, music, and more with easy tap and ride payment. More information on seasonal events at BART.gov/Bartable. Let's go to Hayward and find out what's happening there traffic-wise, and for that we turn to Steve Herrera.
Yes, hey there, Beth. I'm seeing bumper-to-bumper traffic in Hayward southbound Nimitz. Just before A Street, an electric vehicle stuck in the right lane since about 3:30 p.m. A tow truck was called in. No estimated time of arrival for the tow. You're stopped from 238. And it's a mass exodus of vehicles fleeing San Francisco. Eastbound Skyway locked up from 101 to the lower deck of the Bay Bridge. Steve Herrera for KQED.
Well, thank you so much, Steve. Yes, traffic has been quite intense all around the Bay Area today. We do expect the same weather tomorrow with haze.